So, Tori, when you started this business, was it discussed like your name's going to be on this or is it going to be called something else? Like, how did you decide it's going to be your name?
Indeed, I tried so many different names, launched with a terrible name. It was called Tori by TRB because I really didn't want to use my name. I'll never forget. I was having dinner with Kenneth J. Lane and he looked at me and he's like, your name is terrible, Tori by TRB. He said, everyone's calling it Tori Burch anyway. So you got to change the name. And in fact, we did.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Nordy Pod. I'm Pete Nordstrom, president of Nordstrom, and your host for this podcast. Join me as I take you on an honest, authentic journey through our company and introduce you to many of the fascinating people in my life, one episode at a time. This morning, it's really my pleasure to be able to talk with Tori Burch. And Tori, I got to tell you, when I started this podcast thing, it's been about 2 years ago now, you were on my very top of my list originally, and it's taken us almost 2 years to land this. So
you're a busy man, Pete.
Yeah, you're putting that on me? Maybe. It might be me. I don't know. But I'm so glad that we're able to talk because, as we were just talking about, we've known each other a long time, and I really consider you a friend, and it's been great to see all your success and how your business has grown. And frankly, what we've been able to achieve together. So anyway, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm really happy you're doing this.
All right, Tori. So before we get started, I think it's important that I talk a little bit about a lot of the things that you've accomplished because it really is pretty incredible. Now, most people listening to this are going to be familiar with your name through your brand, but let me just go through a list of all these other things that you've been working on and accomplishing as a result of forming this successful brand. Okay, so aside from your hugely successful clothing brand, you've also built the incredibly impactful Tori Burch Foundation, which supports and empowers women entrepreneurs. Your foundation has partnered with Goldman Sachs to provide business education grants, mentoring, and much-needed networking opportunities for women. You've also partnered with Bank of America to provide $100 million in low-cost loans and mentoring support to more than 5,000 women entrepreneurs. You've served on several boards, including the Council of Fashion Designers of America, the Society of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, the Startup America Partnership, and the Barnes Foundation. You were named by the Obama administration as an inaugural member of the Presidential Ambassadors for Global Entrepreneurship. You've constantly been on the Forbes list of the world's 100 most influential women. And I mean, we could go on and on with all your awards and recognitions, but just recently, matter of fact, like today, I heard that you've received yet another really incredible recognition. Just this year, you were added to the Time Magazine's list of 100 most influential people in the world.
I know.
Congratulations.
Can you believe it?
Yeah, I believe it.
It's pretty amazing. Super nice. You know, it's super exciting. It's exciting for our team, really, because I certainly put it with them as well. But I'm deeply honored by that recognition.
Yeah, it should be. It's impressive. There's a lot of impressive folks on that list, and I think it's great. And I would agree. I mean, you know, in our industry, you're enormously influential, and you've been really successful, and the work you've done around your foundation and the philanthropy and everything, I mean, it's just super impressive. And, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting to me is how people go from whatever their origin story is to something that creates success. So I guess what I'm interested to know is, as you were growing up, and if I were talking to the teenage Tori Burch, would you have envisioned yourself, you know, having this kind of success and doing what you're doing now?
God, no, Pete. I honestly grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere and outside of Philadelphia. And I was such an incredible tomboy. My boys laugh when I describe myself that way, but I grew up with three brothers. I grew up outside and really loving sports. And then, you know, going to, when I had to think about what I wanted to major in, it was art history when I went to University of Pennsylvania.
How was that? What was it about art history that got you, curious?
I grew up around art. My parents, you know, loved art. Even it wasn't necessarily, it was all kinds of art because they sort of loved an eclectic mix. And so it was everything from folk art to contemporary, but not as much contemporary. It was more like, you know, any kind of sort of weird, sort of interesting artist and potter. They also loved pottery and ceramics. And so for me, it was just fun and creative. And I loved learning about it. But I took very few, no fashion classes, and I took some fine art classes and loved to draw. So that was something that inspired me in college.
So what did you think you were going to end up doing with all that, like as a career and a life?
Yeah, I mean, I assumed I did some summer internships at Christie's and different galleries. And so I assumed I'd always go into the art world. But then when I was graduating from Penn, I really needed a job. And so my mother and sister-in-law and I brainstormed and just put down a whole bunch of companies and thought, well, my mom wore a lot of Zorin, this incredible fashion designer. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll just send him an email, or not email at the time. It was a call. That was a little before email. And right. And I reached out to him, and he said that not only could I have a job, but I had to start that next week. And I had to figure out how to move from Philadelphia to New York, find an apartment, and have everything all set within a week from graduation.
So what was that initial job? What were your responsibilities?
So it was literally a very glamorous do everything job. It was actually not glamorous at all. It was get coffee. It was shield meetings. He was this incredible designer and didn't really believe in hardware or buttons or trim. And it was just beautiful silhouettes and beautiful fabrics. And so it was fun. I mean, I learned a lot about fashion. We did a lot with fashion shoots, and I'll never forget walking into his office for the first time. It was all white, and he had blue mats on the floor. And then he had a back sewing room, and he looked like Rasputin, and he was the vodka would start at 10 a.m. And it was insane. He always tried to get me to cut my hair, wear flats, and no makeup. And he was so it was fun. And, you know, I'll never forget as well. I met Candy Pratz Price, was a customer and an editor at Vogue. And actually, she was at Harper's Bazaar then. And she came in, and she ended up becoming a friend and offered me my first job outside of Zorin, which was Harper's Bazaar.
And so how old were you at this point?
I was 21.
Oh,
22.
Gosh. So when you were growing up, obviously your parents had an influence on you, and you talked about art and just the whole aesthetic of that. But was fashion on your mind? You talked about being a tomboy and stuff. So but were clothes important to you and that whole idea, how you presented yourself?
You know, I was more, I was teased in college because people called me a proc, and that was half prep, half jock.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't that important to me. I remember, like, you know, going to a prom and my mom getting me my first YSL dress. That was like a big deal back then. And so I had very fashionable parents and who deeply cared about fashion. And my father should have been a designer. He made all of his own clothes, and he was super chic and known for his style. But that was not on my mind at the time.
And so then you ended up getting in the publishing world, right?
Yeah. So I worked at Harper's Bazaar as a sittings assistant after Zorin. And that was interesting because I really learned and went and worked with incredible photographers and went on shoots and, of course, was a wonderful assistant. I say that with a bit of little bit of comedy behind it, because I'm not sure how good I was. But it was really fun to see very high fashion at Harper's Bazaar in the 90s. And after Harper's, I went to Ralph Lauren, which is an amazing training ground for people to learn so many different things. I learned a lot about the concept of lifestyle, which was kind of not an overused word back then. And I worked on advertising and PR there, and then found out I was pregnant with twins and had my babies, and then went back to work at Loewe after 7 years at Vera. And Loewe was my my last job before I officially became a stay-at-home mom. And I remember it was one of those very hard decisions because I loved my career and it was amazing, but I had to travel to Paris and Madrid and I had three babies all of a sudden under the age of four. And so I realized that I would be a jack of all trade, master of none, and if I didn't really just take time off and really focus on my babies, which is what I did. And yeah, it was during those like several years that I knew I wanted to go back to work. I knew that I wanted a career and that being a stay-at-home mom was great for, you know, the time for a short time. And it was when then it is when I concepted the idea of something that I thought was missing in the market. And it was beautifully made and designed pieces that weren't a designer, not weren't a luxury price point. They were designer in spirit, but not a traditional luxury price point because I felt there was a white space in the market. And of course, I did that because I wanted also to start a foundation for women. And I thought that would be, if I could build a successful company, then I would be able to have the financials to start a foundation to empower women. So we launched the company. We started the company in 2004. And then the foundation started in 2009, five years later.
I mean, that's all super ambitious. I mean, most people I talk to when they start like this, it's like, I'm just trying to figure out how to make a living and I'm going to make a t-shirt and see if it sells kind of thing. So you talked about like lifestyle and all that. So when you're originally concepting this in your, you know, what were you in your 20s, were you thinking, I'm going to have clothes, shoes, bags, home, like the whole gamut? It was that part of your mindset?
Well, yeah, I started working on these image books and I thought it would be really interesting to find extraordinary pieces that were classic in spirit that would last and that were hard to find. And that was the starting point. Then I was thinking I wanted to do one store at an out of the way location that wouldn't be an expensive rent. So I found Elizabeth Street. I thought it'd be interesting to show multiple categories so people could see what a brand would look like, even though I don't know exactly if I knew what building a brand even meant back then. I hear myself now and it's a little bit scary because I was saying things that I'm not sure how I even began to say them because I had no experience whatsoever. So, you know, I really started to put things together. My ex-husband had some experience in manufacturing. And so we took some trips to different places in Asia. Since then, we've diversified in every country. And, you know, I kind of knew that I wanted to diversify always, that I would start with a sourcing office and one store. And that's where we began in 2004.
I mean, it's just amazing because the business, as I know it, and certainly as you know it now, it's super complicated. And I would imagine if you knew a lot more, it would have seemed so daunting that you might not have taken it on.
I might not have done it.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, it's like not only do you have to concept ideas, but you got to be able to articulate them in a way where it can lead to production and sourcing and all that stuff that you talked about. It goes beyond just creative. I mean, there's all these touch points that have to work that bring something to life, and to do it in one store where you don't have any scale, right, to be able to bang around and figure it out.
I launched e-commerce as well. And back then, people told me no one would ever buy online. People told me never to save business. And they said charity work, not even philanthropy in the same sentence. And they also told me never to launch with a retail direct-to-consumer model.
Is that right?
And the other thing was I was advised really, really strongly not to launch with multiple categories.
And so when you said you launched, I mean, how many categories did you have at the outset?
I had about 10 categories because it was handbags, you know, a tote, some footwear, ready to wear, jewelry, swim, a little bit of home, tiny towels. We did a sunglass. We did some espadrilles. Yeah. So probably 8 categories.
Yeah. I mean, were you then in a position where you put all this out there, you had some of it online, and you start chasing what's working?
Well, yeah, I mean, so we had an event to open our store, which was not ready. We opened without the doors in place. It was during February Fashion Week. And so it was, I remember it was actually quite chilly, but we invited friends, family, out of town press during Fashion Week from 10 in the morning until 6 at night. And it was like we were giving product away, and it became word of mouth throughout the day. And so,
what do you mean you were giving it away? Literally?
It was because they were looking at the quality and the design, and they thought that it was very inexpensive for what it was. And so they, you know, I think we realized we hit a chord that very first day, and we literally almost sold through our inventory.
I mean, I remember knowing about your brand early on, and there was a lot of buzz about it. I mean, you talked about just, you know, that first day and during Fashion Week, and it was kind of buzzy. And so, but when did you know that you actually had something that was more than just, oh, maybe I'll have a store someday, that it was bigger and more than that?
I mean, I will say in the beginning, we knew early on that there was more potential. I did have a 5-year plan that we sort of disregarded at the end. I think it was to open 3 stores in 5 years. We ended up opening 12. And also, I was really interested in learning e-commerce, because not many people were on e-commerce, but it was an interesting way to get people and sites on your brand and interact with a customer in a different way than retail was. And I was very interested in that. Of course, we were on Oprah the first year of business.
So how did that happen?
How did it happen? It happened because a guy, an editor that worked there named Adam Glassman, was a friend of mine. And we all grew up together, editors. And like I was, you know, as I mentioned, all the different times I interacted with a lot of different editors. He was one of the people that I met. And he had given her some of our pieces for Christmas. And so she ended up really liking them. And she was doing a show called The Next Big Thing. And she picked us for The Next Big Thing in fashion. And that was very exciting. I mean, I thought it was a joke. I thought my brothers were playing a joke on me when we got a call from her office saying that you need to not only not go away on spring break, you need to come to Chicago and do a fashion show. And you're going to be on TV, by the way. And so I went to Chicago. I'll never forget, because I went with a friend of mine and my sister-in-law. And she looked at me the minute before I went on air, and she said, "Have you ever been on TV?" And I said, "Oh, no." And she said, "Don't worry, it's 30 million viewers." And so I started to laugh. And it was just from that moment on, it was kind of amazing.
And what specifically were you showing, and what was getting the hits? Was it shoes? Was it clothes?
Well, no, it was a fashion show on real women.
Oh, my.
So, it was not on models. It was on real women. And so we did, you know, looks with footwear and with some totes, with tunics. And she was dressed in our Dickie sweater. I'll never forget it. It was the silver with the lamé collar and cuffs. And I was wearing a tunic. And so, yeah, that was the beginning of the Oprah effect, which is very real.
Oh, it's totally real. We've had that experience ourselves when she'll do favorite things, and it might be something we carry. And you could see it. It would just blow up like immediately. So if any brand could get their stuff on Oprah, it's probably still the same way. If she's endorsing something, it's probably pretty great. So what year was that when you were on Oprah?
So that was 2005. It was a year after I started our company.
God, that's amazing. So it was from the beginning, you've got a really immediate need and stuff that's happening. But the fact is, your name's on the business, too. I guess you and I have somewhat something in common there, that my name's on our business, but I didn't create it. But it definitely, it gives me a sense of responsibility to think about a much longer term proposition. Because whether I'm working here or not, or whatever's going to happen, my name's still on the side of this building, you know, so it matters.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think anything matters that you start, and any kind of startup that you're associated with, it certainly it takes it to a different level when it's your name. But I do feel that any founder I ever talk to, regardless of name or not, it's still like an extension of you. And I think that, you know, I was really interested in building something that would last, because I had this idea of impact and scale around women, and how do we create something that stands for positive change and also can really impact the lives of women. And that could be starting from certainly products and confidence and making them feel great and things that they're wearing, but also tying it into our foundation and the work we do around women's empowerment and supporting women entrepreneurs.
So you had a couple things going on. You're creating a business. It's for women that are customers, but you're also employing people. So that's something that's more than just running a business. Did you have that idea, like, I'm creating a business, I can employ women, I can give them opportunities? Was that part of the agenda too?
That was definitely part of it. I think we're 84% women, our business. It was also the culture of the company was tied into that as well, as how do we create an incredible place to work, a safe place to work, and a place where women can thrive and also have a family.
Yeah, you talk about that too. I'm curious. I mean, you got so many things that I want to ask about, but you know, particularly in those days, you were doing something that was breaking a little bit of a glass ceiling. It wasn't super common that a woman would have kids and all that, and then have this business that she's running too. And so was that part of your mindset all along, is like, yeah, I'm going to have a family, I'm going to do all that, but not at the expense of having my business as well?
I was surprised about a lot of things around women in business when I got into the workforce. I grew up with three brothers and I thought I could do anything that my brothers could do, essentially. I think when I realized some of the challenges that women faced, and even myself, I realized I couldn't be a successful mom at the time and keep the pace I was keeping at work. It was hard for me to go to a doctor appointment. It was hard for me to get time off when I needed it to do something with my children. So it was kind of, that was in sort of the mindset of that I wanted to build a place that was different.
Particularly, you know, when kids are young, it's tough. I mean, there's a lot of demands on people's time. Was there ever moments where it felt like, I don't know if I can do this, or this isn't going to work? Or
I mean, there were definitely moments. I thankfully, you know, listen, I went through a lot. I had a very public divorce. We're friends now. I can say that. But it was not fun. I was so, after about 4 years or 3.5 years of the business, I was a single mom. So that was a whole other part that was, difficult to say
yeah,
the least,
for
to,
sure.
to raise three boys and three stepdaughters in New York City, running a business. It was a lot, you can imagine. So there were times, but I had a great support system. I had an incredible family. My brother works here and has helped me build the business over time, and an incredible network of friends as well. So when I did have those moments of self-doubt and lack of confidence and thinking I can't go forward, I powered through. And I'm not sure where that resilience came from, but it was definitely something that I had to work at.
So as you look back at that now, I mean, how does it make you feel? I mean, to that point, you're living in the moment. You're doing what you got to do. As you describe it, a single mom starting a business and having all this going on, I can only imagine, as you reflect back on that, it's got to be pretty interesting for you.
Yeah. And listen, I'm proud of the resilience I had when I look back. And I think I'm proud of the way my boys feel because I also managed to keep them a bit sheltered from the fashion industry as a whole and maintain a level of privacy. I think it was definitely a balance of figuring that part out as well. And I never wanted my career to influence who they became as people. So I wanted them to have a very wholesome childhood as much as you can in New York City, but also be a bit sheltered from not fashion as a whole, but the world as a whole, and just sort of have a childhood. So it was really trying to make sure that happened.
So as you look back on that, I mean, does it feel like mission accomplished? Do you feel good about how that's all worked out?
I think there's been so much fun and excitement along the way with them, but no, really, they're great kids, and they definitely put me through, you know, normal things that parents go through. And it was hard at times, but they're amazing and they're doing great.
That's awesome. So on the foundation thing, one thing that's interesting, what it implies you say a foundation is you're actually doing the work. You're not just making some money and writing a check and have it go somewhere. So talk a little bit about what you were trying to achieve with that foundation that, again, goes beyond just writing a check to a charity.
Yeah. I mean, listen, well, checks are part of it, where we did partner with Bank of America and gave access to low interest loans to women entrepreneurs. And we reached $100 million in low interest loans, which was a very exciting milestone that we just recently reached. We partnered with Goldman Sachs to work with their 10,000 small business programs to help with education and mentoring. But really, one thing that I was very interested in doing is having our own fellowship program, having our own ability to mentor people. And that's something, and also helping create networks for women. I think one thing that men are great at is networking, and women need the community and they need the networks. And so that's something that we are actively pursuing and still working on, and creating these networks for women. And regardless of their businesses, they're experiencing many of the same challenges. So it's really invaluable for them to have the knowledge that other entrepreneurs are going through, having access to low interest loans, and then also education programs. And we pumped that up a lot during COVID, and we pivoted, and we really worked at what women needed when they needed it. And that's something that we're, the agility there is critical.
Yeah, you know, when you run the business, it's pretty easy to define what success looks like, because there's these objective measures that have to do with sales, making money. Can you talk about how you define success when you're operating a foundation and trying to, you know, do this work?
Well, I mean, just this morning, we have 50 of our fellows in that come to New York City for a week. And just seeing the room, to me, is a success. You have 50 incredible women, all kinds of businesses from almost every state in the U.S. come in, and just hearing the impact that we all are having, my team is having on them, and boosting their confidence, helping them with strategy, making introductions to different services they need, or potential even maybe investors. And really, when we can help them scale their business and reach $1 million in revenue, we see a successful business with longevity. And that's our goal, is to really get women over that million mark, and as many as we can, and help them go beyond that.
Yeah, that's impressive. It's really great. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and, you know, you've been around brands in the industry a long time, is, you know, brands have an arc to them. Most of them do. And, you know, you've been doing this for a while now, and you've had a lot of success. And one of the things that strikes me, I mean, the last year or so has been really good for you, it seems like, in terms of the acclaim that you're getting around what you're doing, and the buzz around your brand again. I mean, it's not something that happened and then it's waned over time. I mean, there's ups and downs in all businesses, but it feels like, and I'm curious from your perspective, this last year, I'm hearing a lot about your brand. It's out there in the zeitgeist of stuff that people are interested in, you know, fashion people. There's a lot of credibility of what's going on there and a lot of excitement. So I'm just curious, do you feel like something's really happened here in the last year or so?
Well, you know, Pete, a lot has happened. I think one thing that has really happened is my husband came on board. I had to marry him to get him to be CEO, you know, because he came and then COVID happened 8 months later. So we were just getting started. And I can tell you, when he came, he had some work to do. But he's a huge impact. And I think that it really freed me up to stop being the CEO and having any responsibilities from an operations standpoint, and really focus my time on the creative process. And that's really what my passion is. And in a way, if you think about it, when I started the company, it was more about the creative, because it was really creating something from scratch. And then through the years, the business sort of overtook me and my time.
Right.
And so Pure Eve has allowed me to really have the time. Like, I used to spend roughly 30% of my time on design. And if you think about it, the rest was spent working on the operations, building stores, doing everything that a CEO needed to be responsible for. So it's really more running the business. Now I'm 100% focused on design. And it's a very, I feel like a new designer. So for me, we're starting again. I think it's really rare that a company is like our, like any company can do that. Usually they change creative directors and it becomes right. a whole new, you know, concept. And for me, I had to challenge myself to change everything and keep some things and not alienate our customer in the process. And so it's been this curve of really relooking at all of our beautiful things we're known for, making them better. Let's start with that. That was one of the initiatives. I wanted to make everything we did better, but also I wanted it to be a more personal reflection of my style. And it doesn't mean that I would wear everything or should or want to, but it's how I see, it's not reflecting my style. It's how I see women dress and how I want women to dress.
So how do you keep this, the spirit of intent around what you're doing to reflect your sensibility around fashion without it literally being about you? You know what I mean? Because I've had experience, you know, working here with women buyers. I think some of the challenges when they first started, the first thing they do is they buy things they like, that they want to do, when it isn't necessarily serving the customer. But you've got a really good grounding, I think, on who your customer is, what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and I think our customer is ever evolving. We definitely have a young customer, and we definitely have all ages. But when you think about a lot of designers for women's wear are men. And they're not designing for themselves.
Right.
It's kind of an interesting question. I don't know that it's relevant for me because I'm not necessarily designing what I want to wear, but I do. I'm wearing it right now. I love a lot of what we make, but it's really how I see women. And really it's kind of thinking about where women are today and what they're, but my take on it. I think that's the important thing. You need to have your own unique point of view.
Yeah, you definitely, it seems like your fingerprints on all that. It's interesting you mentioned that there's men designers in our business. And I'm always struck when I'm at a fashion show and I'll watch them come out after. And the guys are always dressed the same. They're like wearing a pair of jeans or like a white t-shirt or a sweater. There's nothing about whatever they've designed that is a reflection of what they're personally doing themselves. Is that right? I mean, it's like they know what they're designing for.
It's absolutely right. And I have to say, even me coming out in shows now, I'm not really thinking about, it's very different. You kind of want to take a backstage to what you present. It's really an interesting way to look at the creative process. It's very different. And it started when COVID also happened. It gave me time to actually reflect. I had no time, Pete. I was running all over the world, trying to open stores, do PAs, work on so many different things. And in a way, I felt like I was being pulled in so many different directions. When COVID happened, I had to look within. And in a way, that very first collection we did was kind of a palate cleanser for me. It was based on Shaker and the way I grew up, which was around Quaker schools. And it was more minimalist. It was definitely like for me, sort of a start to a new chapter.
So talk about your journey as a creative person, because you started out, you weren't literally a designer, but you were interested in the creative process. You were interested in fashion. How has that evolved so that based on all the things that you learned, do you feel like you're a designer now or do you feel like you're more of a creative leader, I guess?
I was talking to our entrepreneurs this morning and someone said she's designing, but she doesn't feel like a designer. And I said, you know, it's interesting. A lot of designers don't have traditional education around design. I absolutely feel like a designer after 20 years of learning
you should.
How to design.
Yes.
So I do, you know, for a long time in the beginning, I felt awkward calling myself a designer because I didn't feel I had the right. I definitely feel I have the right to call myself a designer today. I've learned on the job and it hasn't been always easy, but it's been super gratifying and wonderful. But I do feel like I'm finally coming into my own from a design perspective and really having the ability to have the time dedicated that it takes to really reflect where I want it to go. And of course, surrounding myself with, again, an extraordinary team of people.
So give me a little bit of an idea, like, as you're thinking about the future. I mean, you've talked about the last couple of years being a catalyst for you to, you know, really be focused on the design and take it to a new place. But how do you think about the next few years and where you're trying to take the business?
Well, I think in many ways, I feel like we're just starting again. And we just, you know, having Pure Eve has been transformative for our business, for our company, for our team. Having a leader of his caliber is so exciting. And, you know, people ask me if it was hard to give up the CEO title. It was the easiest thing I've ever done. I did it for 14 years, but really having someone with Pure Eve's expertise is very exciting for us. So we're really just beginning again, and I feel completely energized. I mean, and also 20 years isn't an old, is quite new if you think about it for a company. It's still feeling its way and building, and so we're really excited.
All right, I got a question for you. So we've been doing business together, and you use the word partnership and stuff, and it feels to me that we've gone way beyond a transactional relationship. I mean, your brand is a very big and important part of our business, and it matters a lot to us. And, you know, I know there's a lot of push and pull about trying to accomplish stuff that's of mutual benefit. But I'm curious, you know, since you've got me here and I've been asking you all kinds of questions, what kind of advice do you have for me as a person that is a partner to a brand like yours? Like, what can we be doing better? And how could we, you know, be on the forefront of evolving the business, a department store business, and make it more relevant?
Yeah, I mean, listen, one thing I've been impressed with Nordstrom in particular is your embrace of innovation and technology. And how do you also not lose sight of your customer? I think that customer is critical, and your embrace of young designers and innovation is also something I'm really impressed with. I think that's important. I think highlighting and trying new things, whether it's this pop-up we did in Miami. I just also remember when we did that roadshow, Pete, a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's really important not to lose that connectivity. And I think, you know, listen, I think we could all be doing better all the time. So for me, it's like I'm open like you are to feedback. But I think that the connectivity with your customer is critical to also understand that women want fashion. They want newness. They want that, not to just get into a place where it's repetitive. I think that the concept of surprise and delight is really important.
I completely agree. And it's the one evergreen part of our business here. The tactics of how to do it may evolve and change, but the spirit of what we're trying to do around be relevant for customers and give them a reason to buy something new and all that stuff and try new things.
I mean, desirability. I keep thinking of desirability.
Yeah, that's a great word. And I'm gonna use that with our team because, you know, it's hard. It's a big business for it not to become kind of a transactional thing where you're basically looking at last year and doing some kind of version of last year. But
I don't like last year-itis, Pete.
Yeah, I don't either. But it's hard, you know, because you live with it too. It's hard to break from that, right? I mean, because you've got a lot of pressure of people. I mean, to your point about not wanting to disappoint customers, there's a subset of our customers that don't want us ever to change anything.
Good to have some consistency of things that people know they can get with you.
Yeah.
And certainly even with us, if we have a great fitting pant, people want to continue that pant.
Right.
But they also want to have inspiring pieces that are unique and different and not feel cookie cutter.
Yeah. Hey, look, Tori, you've been so nice to do this. I really appreciate it. I want to congratulate you for all your success. And I'm so glad I've known you for, you know, this many years. I've been able to have kind of a front row seat for it. So anyway, good on you. It's great. And it's fun for me to see your success.
Thank you for being such an extraordinary partner. I really appreciate it, Pete. And I, as you said, it's not transactional. This is a real partnership, and working together to have an exciting new future is something I'm passionate about.
Well, that's the show. We're really glad you're with us on this journey, and we hope you keep listening. The easiest way to do that is to subscribe to the Nordy Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please take a minute to give us a like, a share, and a review so other people can find this thing too. For more information about the show, head to Nordstrom.com/NordyPodcast or follow us on our Instagram page at the Nordy Pod to stay up to date on new episodes, announcements, and more. We'd also really like to hear about your experience with Nordstrom, so if you have a story about how you received great service or even bad service, send us an email to NordyPodcast@Nordstrom.com. You can even give us a call and leave a voicemail, and you may just get a chance to talk to me personally on a future episode of the show. That number is 206-594-0526. If you don't happen to have a specific Nordstrom story, we'd also just love to hear your thoughts on the show itself. Do you have any guest suggestions or interest in parts of the business that we've never really touched on? Let us know what you'd like to hear. Drop us a line and be part of the Nordy Pod. And make sure to tune in next time when we take you on an in-depth look at a massively vital segment of our business with our Vice President of Customer Care, Jim Gallagher. Join me for my chat with Jim and a few of his care team members who regularly engage with customers and strive to make every Nordstrom interaction a positive experience. Next time on the Nordy Pod.